I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. What is endgame in Gaza? Israeli officials today say they are in an all-out war with Hamas militants. They say they don't want to kill Palestinian civilians, but the Palestinian death toll climbs in the third day of Israeli attacks, attacks which are in response to Hamas rockets that have been raining on Israel in recent weeks. For an update, we turn to Ethan Bronner, Jerusalem bureau chief for The New York Times. And Ethan, what is the latest there? The images of bloody Palestinians beneath rubble being rushed into understaffed Palestinian hospitals is pretty compelling. What's going on?
Well, those are real images. That's what's been going on, certainly mostly on Saturday. There was an incredible set of simultaneous attacks on Saturday that led to those most of those pictures. And that day, it was for the police stations and security compounds. Today, Monday, is more sort of institutions of Hamas, the Interior Ministry, the Presidential Guest House, the Islamic University, that sort of thing. And shots at various chemistry laboratories and various militant leaders. Five guys were hit in a car who were members of Islamic Jihad in the last couple of hours. So it's ongoing.
And is Hamas still launching rockets into Israel?
Actually, surprisingly, more than it did the first few days. In the first 2 days of the conflict, the Israeli press was saying, where are all of the Qassam rockets? We expected 200 a day, which is what happened from Hezbollah in 2006 in that war that Israel led in Lebanon. But there, the first couple of days, there were more like 20 or 30. But today, there were 50 or 60, and a couple of fairly long-range ones. And a man was killed in Ashkelon in a sort of ironic note, he was an Israeli Arab construction worker, and those who were injured around him were as well.
Well, so if Israel's aim with this attack was to stop the rockets being fired into Israel, it doesn't seem as if it succeeded on that level.
The Israeli military argument from the beginning is that it would take some days or weeks or months, that they are systematically going after the various storehouses and weapons construction places and guys who do it, and it'll take a while.
Well, and why is this happening now? There had been rocket barrages into Israel. There was a ceasefire that expired. But the British newspaper The Guardian is writing this morning that this operation was planned by Israel for 6 months.
The Israeli military has been planning and thinking about this and collecting intelligence about it for many months. Around the same time that it signed a calm or a ceasefire with Hamas in June, it began very serious intelligence collection for this operation. But it, its officials insisted it was quite reluctant to go ahead with it, and in fact only went ahead with it when Hamas declared the ceasefire over in mid-December and then began to launch dozens of Qassams again. But your answer about why now, I think the answer is that before the ceasefire, Israel was considering that it needed to do this. They agreed to a ceasefire and decided to give it a try. The Qassams never stopped during the ceasefire. They certainly went way down in number. And Hamas feels that it didn't get its share of the deal, which is a huge increase in commercial goods coming into it, and kept up some low level of rocket fire. But in any case, when it was all over in November, December, Hamas stepped it up and hugely, arguing that that Israel had not kept up its end of the bargain and was not serious. And then Israel said, well, it's clear that who's not serious here. And then they launched their attack.
Well, you also mentioned the 2006 flawed Israeli war against the militant group Hezbollah in Lebanon. And you write today that this operation might also be a little bit about expunging that memory of that failed attack with a successful one. But what about on the Palestinian side? Just briefly, as we remember, Hamas has control of Gaza. The Palestinian Authority is running the West Bank, which has had some success, some peace recently. What have PLO leaders been saying from the West Bank about Israel attacking Hamas in Gaza?
They have said publicly, they have expressed horror and shock and anger about it. And I think that when I say publicly, I don't mean to suggest that it's a cynical statement, but it is a somewhat delicate question. Many of them hate Hamas almost as much as Israel hates Hamas. They fought their own little war, one against the other, in June of 2007 when Hamas threw out the Palestinian Authority from Gaza in a fairly brutal way. And when you talk to leaders of the Palestinian Authority and the PLO, they speak in very vicious terms about their aims for Hamas. That said, seeing hundreds of people killed at the hands of Israel is not something that they are expressing any joy about. And I think that privately, what they really want to do is try to get some kind of a renewed calm between Israel and Hamas. But, you know, there is certainly an undertow of not wanting Hamas to emerge triumphant for them as well, because ultimately they want to defeat Hamas as well. But they don't want to be seen to be riding in on Israeli tanks to do so.
Ethan Bronner, we just have a couple of seconds left. You said that that Israeli officials say that this is a long-term project. What do you see as endgame? Where are we?
How is it going to end, you're asking me?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm afraid I can't really answer that. The Israeli argument is that they are going to so pummel Hamas and its organization and its infrastructure that it will have nothing left, essentially, to shoot at Israel, and it will sign an agreement with more specifics and a greater clarity that there will not be any rockets coming into Israel and that they will no longer build up their military through smuggling tunnels and so on. That is Israel's aim. Israeli military people seem to think it's a realistic aim. It's very hard for me to tell you whether it is a realistic aim.
Ethan Bronner, Jerusalem Bureau Chief of the New York Times from Jerusalem. Ethan, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Rob.
Now to the U.S. economy. This week we want to take a look at different aspects of the economy. Tomorrow, unemployment. Today, homelessness. And it's no surprise they're connected. Jobless claims are near a 26-year high, foreclosures are skyrocketing, and homelessness is on the rise. A new survey by the U.S. Conference of Mayors found that 19 out of 25 cities studied have seen homelessness increase in recent months by an average of 12%. We know shelters are full. We've reported on families squeezing in a relative's homes, pets being put up for adoption. The Greater Boston Food Bank, here where we are, says it may have to make cuts to stay afloat. So our next guest has a lot on his plate. Philip Mangano is the executive director of the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness. He was appointed by President Bush in 2002. Before that, he was a homeless advocate here in Massachusetts. And he joins us now. And Philip, we know more than 2 million people experience homelessness in a given year. That's around 1% of the population. But is that a true number? Does it take into account families who may have, for instance, been foreclosed and moved in with relatives?
Well, what the research shows is that on any given night in our country, about 670,000 Americans are experiencing homelessness. I think, though, that obviously will change a bit given what I call the double trouble. The double trouble of the mortgage foreclosure on the one hand, which affects primarily families, low-income families. But I was just in Miami, actually, with Mayor Diaz, and the person who picked me up from the airport, he said he himself lived in a duplex. One day, at about 8 o'clock at night, a knock came on the door. He turned to his wife. She didn't know who it was. They went to the door, opened it, and they were served. They had 5 days to get out of that apartment because the owner of that duplex had been foreclosed on. That's who we're seeing. It's not so much people who own their own home and who have been foreclosed on. It's people at the lower end of the economic spectrum who have been playing by the rules, and suddenly a financial transaction takes place that they're not aware of, and they find themselves evicted.
Well, let's just stay there for a second, and you can add to that layoffs and people who've lost their job and can't make their mortgage payments because that's increasingly happening too. But staying in Miami, we just did a story on a homeless advocate in Miami who's taking things into his own hands. Mm-hmm. The Miami Herald has been reporting that the city there got federal funds to build low-income housing. They did not do it. There was corruption and other issues. And this guy said, you know what? I'm just going to take the homeless people. I'm going to go find those foreclosed homes. And I'm going to put the homeless people in the foreclosed homes, try to stop me. And no one in the city has said anything, and he's doing this.
Well, just to say a couple of things. One, Mayor Diaz, who is the mayor of Miami, has caused great change there, and it's moved away from its old reputation. Actually, there are 67% fewer people on the streets of Miami than there were 5 years ago because of the 10-year plan. And that's, of course, the effort that we've made around the country, initiated with mayors. There are 350 10-year plans around the country. They're making a difference, especially for those people who are experiencing chronic homelessness, those who live on the streets or languish in shelters. I can certainly understand the urgency of anyone seeing this crisis hit families, because the last thing we want in this country is for people to be catapulted into the long misery of homelessness. Homelessness is a human tragedy, and the idea is to bring it to an end.
Well, we will talk about your 10-year plan to create housing for the chronically homeless. These are the 10 to 20% who just live from shelter to shelter. But I want to stay for a moment with the people who are acutely, suddenly homeless because of unemployment or high foreclosures. How much does their problem come back to an overall policy problem? I mentioned corruption, but I'm also thinking, did the federal government push the private lenders, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which have since been taken over by the government, but did the federal government years ago push them too hard to get people into mortgages instead of pushing developers and people who received federal money to build affordable rental housing?
Well, for 20 years, in this administration and in the previous administration, there was a mantra in terms of home ownership. I think there was a sense that we wanted more people to realize the American dream, and it was well-intentioned for the most part, because what we discovered from the research was that Caucasian home ownership was at a much higher level than Black or Hispanic home ownership rates. And we know that home ownership in the past built equity, and that's a very good way to get out of poverty and to stay out of poverty. So many of the initiatives were in fact targeted to bring some equity in terms of minority home ownership with majority home ownership.
And we also know that there was historically in the 50s, 60s, 70s, things like redlining, people just literally not giving mortgages to people of color, to minorities. So we know that that was true, and this was an attempt to reverse that.
Yeah, exactly. In many communities, there was a call to increase home ownership. And so much of the resources of housing in our country were devoted to realizing the American dream. But I think in pursuing the American dream for our poorest neighbors, we ignored for a while the American promise. And I think the American promise is that you'll have a roof over your head. If you work, you'll have a roof over your head. What we're discovering now is that there are a lot of Americans who are working who can't afford a roof over their head. And that's why in homelessness policy for the last 7 years, we've increased the resources targeted to homeless people. But more importantly in that is that a priority for those resources is to create housing that is specifically targeted to our neighbors who don't have a place to live, to get them off the streets, out of shelters, and into housing.
That's Philip Mangano. He's sort of the federal homeless czar. Well, when we come back, we'll hear more about his push to get the chronically homeless into permanent supportive housing. It's a program that's been praised, but there's also some concern that it might take funds from homeless shelters. Speaking of which, later today you have 3 days to make your tax-deductible contribution to, say, a homeless shelter, and advocates are praying that the bad economy won't keep you from doing that, as we're going to hear later. Back in 1 minute, here and now. Welcome back to our conversation with the Bush administration's homeless czar, Philip Mangano. He's been praised for his Housing First initiative, which targets the chronically homeless. Now, this is the 10 to 20% of the homeless population that boomerangs through shelters and hospitals over decades. And Phil Mangano has been trying to get these men and women off the streets into permanent housing. And Phil, you say what? That this is more humane and cost-effective because it provides health care and addiction counseling as well as a roof, you know, in one place?
It's called permanent supportive housing. And what it recognizes is that for our most vulnerable and disabled neighbors who are homeless, simply placing them in housing and think we've solved the problem, it just hasn't worked. Those of us who are old enough to remember what was called deinstitutionalization, which began in the 60s, remember that we placed people out of the back wards of mental institutions into our communities in YMCA, YWCA, rooming house, lodging house rooms, but we forgot to provide the services that would support their tenancies. And that led to pervasive street homelessness, direct correlation. What we learned, for the very vulnerable population. You have to provide them with a place to live, but also customized support services to support people in that housing. When you do that, what the data says is that the retention rate for the most vulnerable people, 85% for that population.
That means 85% of these chronically homeless have stayed in the homes where they've been moved. The New York Times reports the number of chronically homeless has dropped by 30% in recent years, and they attribute that in part to this permanent housing program. But as you well know, on the other hand, San Francisco announced it would stop financing homeless advocacy groups that didn't send the homeless to permanent housing. And now shelters are worried that they're not going to get funding. Instead, the push will be to get people out of shelters, and that this focus on the chronically homeless comes just as the larger percentage of homeless people, the 85% that aren't chronic, is ballooning.
So let me tackle those one at a time. First on the 30%, between 2005 and 2007, for our most vulnerable and disabled neighbors, who also turn out to be the most expensive and randomly ricocheting through very expensive health and law enforcement systems, that number dropped 30%. And those numbers, despite the mortgage foreclosure crisis coupled with job losses, those numbers are actually staying down. We have seen an uptick in family numbers, no question about that. But the number of individuals continue to stay down. So that's a good thing. With regard to San Francisco, I was literally just on the phone with Mayor Gavin Newsom out in San Francisco. And what they've discovered in San Francisco is, by talking to the consumer, and we've discovered this nationally, if we talk to providers, we hear one thing about what homeless people want. When you ask a homeless person what they want, they never say they want a pill, a program, or a protocol. They ask for one thing. It's a place to live. Homeless people want their homelessness ended.
What are you saying? Are you saying that these homeless advocacy groups are just kind of, you know, afraid of losing their money if they lose their chronically homeless to homes?
There are no question that homeless providers and advocates, for the most part, are absolutely well-intentioned. But here's what we've learned in the last 20 years. If good intentions and humanitarian gestures could end homelessness, it would have been history decades ago. That's not enough. We've funded programs for years that served homeless people endlessly. Now we need to invest in the result of literally ending people's homelessness.
But still, you know, in this effort to move the chronically homeless out of shelters and reduce the shelters, doesn't that ultimately hurt those who are suddenly homeless? If you close the shelters, is there going to be a place for them?
Our target is to end all of homelessness. But to think you can abolish the entire issue all at the same time is naive. We tried that for 25 years. It didn't work. So now we're looking at the most complex, the most disabled, the most vulnerable. And that strategy is backed up by people like Malcolm Gladwell, whose tipping point tells us you can't dissipate the resources across the entire breadth of a big social problem. You have to go after the most visible expression of the big social problem, concentrate resources there to create a psychological and resource tipping point to affect the entire problem. We're doing that in this country right now, and we've begun with the chronic homeless. But that priority on the chronic is not an exclusivity. Yeah. Half of the money that we expend in Washington on homelessness goes to families, even though families don't even constitute half of the population. So much resource is expended on those populations, but we're targeting literally the people who will potentially die on our streets. So that's our priority.
Well, Bob Erlenbush, who I'm sure you're well aware of, serves on the board of the advocacy group, the National Coalition for the Homeless, said a few years back, is that, you know, nobody's saying it's not good to get the chronically homeless out of the shelters, but that he says it glossed over the fact that federal programs for low-income housing, which can prevent homelessness, have either languished in the Bush years or been cut. You just made a face. What's that face?
Well, first of all, the fact is, for example, in the Section 8 program that's been castigated for years by advocates, there has never been a reduction in the Section 8 program. In fact, it's increased every single year.
This is the low-income housing.
A voucher program that gives subsidies to low-income people. The fact is that Bob is right that for 25 years, the resources dedicated to housing in our country have diminished, and that is absolutely a part of the difficulty. It's not that Section 8 or other housing resources have diminished in this administration. It's that in general, there hasn't been a lot of political will on the issue of housing. When was the last time we heard a presidential debate where housing was a focus of that debate? We haven't heard that. Not a lot of political will. The advocacy hasn't worked from the top down in terms of getting a better housing policy and then that having a trickle-down effect on homelessness. We're doing the opposite. We're going straight after homelessness to see if by going the inductive route, we can't have an impact on housing. We now have 700 mayors and county executives around our country. They all have 10-year plans to end homelessness. Not only have they talked to the people in this administration that I served and brought some remedy to what other cuts might have been made, but I think there are going to be very important voices in the upcoming administration to bring additional remedy to the housing crisis. And part of the reason for that is we've demonstrated that you can take federal resources and invest them in field-tested initiatives that create results.
So to help the most vulnerable, the chronic, and in so doing, spread out and help the acute, the suddenly homeless, the families, the children. And
all you have to do is read Malcolm Gladwell's book, The Tipping Point, to know how to create a strategy that works.
Philip Mangano, Executive Director of the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness, and before that, as we said, a homeless advocate here in Massachusetts. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Robin.
Okay. Tomorrow on Here and Now, is there really a credit crunch? Well, it depends on who you ask. And still ahead, the book that's topped one bestseller list for 31 weeks, that's after the news, Here and Now. If you're sitting down to make a year-end charitable donation, is the Wall Street meltdown staying your hand? What about Bernard Madoff, who allegedly made off with personal savings and foundation money that was earmarked for charities? The Chronicle of Philanthropy surveyed charities to find out what impact the economic downturn is having, and with time running out to make 2008 tax-deductible donations, we thought we'd see what they found. Stacey Palmer is editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Stacey, how would you describe the climate for charitable giving overall?
It's a very shaky environment right now. People are giving to the causes that they care about, but they just can't afford to give as much as they did in the past. So we see people giving to charities that feed the hungry, help the homeless, those kinds of groups that it's very clear that they need money. So those groups are actually seeing increases, not enough to meet the demand, but they are seeing increases. But other kinds of organizations, arts groups, environmental groups, those kinds of things, they're having a lot of trouble raising money.
Well, let's take that sort of downturn first, because you looked at surveys from, for instance, the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. They surveyed 660 groups, found that more than half reported declines, and many organizations are cutting staff.
Absolutely. Nonprofits do everything they can to make sure that they can continue to provide services. So they look at ways that they can cut back on any inefficiencies. And that's what they're doing right now, is trying to make sure that they're as lean as possible before they have to start cutting back services.
Right. In December, a poll of 70 human service charities in the Silicon Valley area in California found a 34% reported a decrease. But then you also report that in Syracuse, New York, the Salvation Army has donations up by about 20% this year. You mentioned some groups have reported a rise. And why in that case, the Salvation Army in Syracuse?
In a lot of cases, the charities have been very effective in getting their messages out to say there are all of these people who, for the first time, are turning to soup kitchens, homeless shelters, all of the kinds of social services that the very poor have long depended on. Now middle-class people are turning to those organizations, in part because they've lost their home due to foreclosures or they've lost their job. So as people hear about those stories and the nonprofits have gotten that message out, they've been able to raise significant funds. But even in cases where they might say have a 20% increase in donations, they have a 50% increase in demand for services. So it's still not enough to keep pace.
Have you ever seen the kind of conditions that we have now, not just the collapse of Wall Street, but the Madoff scandal?
Right. The Madoff scandal has made a lot of people very nervous about just how safe their charitable contributions are. And people are always nervous about whether a nonprofit manages its finance as well. Surveys have always found that people trust charities to do a great job of providing services, but they've always been a little bit skeptical about whether they're terrific at managing their money. But certainly a lot of people are wondering whether their investment committees were doing enough due diligence.
Well, and we should, I mean, we probably don't need to explain that many of these huge charities charities, the Jet Foundation, for instance, that supports social justice groups, is going to stop making grants, close its doors next month. This is a group that funds, for instance, Physicians for Human Rights, and we reported on this. And a lot of these charities and foundations put all of their investment with Madoff instead of spreading it around.
Yes, it's absolutely amazing that they didn't realize diversification was so important. And one of the things that even some attorneys generals are starting to look at the boards of trustees, should they have been watching things more carefully so that didn't happen. But we've never seen a case where foundations have been shutting their doors almost the day that they heard the news that all of their money was gone. It's absolutely amazing.
Well, let's take a look at some other aspects of charitable giving. You write that the charities with the biggest drops are community foundations and other organizations that allow people to set up donor-advised funds. What are those?
Those are sort of like charity checking accounts, and they're very popular with people because you often set it up either at a community foundation or a financial services company like Fidelity or Schwab. And it's very easy for you to put the money in, you get a tax break, and then when you decide that it's time to support a particular cause, you can go ahead and write that check anytime. So you might get the tax break this year and not actually disperse any money until 5 years from now. It's just an easy administrative tool for people who have enough money to give away many thousands of dollars rather than just a few hundred dollars.
Well, I'm sure those have taken a hit because people's pension plans and stock investments have taken a hit.
Right. Stock is usually the way people set up those funds. And there's a terrific tax break when your stock has gone up in value. Giving it to a charity is a terrific idea to save money on your taxes. But since most people are not facing that situation, instead, it's exactly the opposite. Very few people have any stock gains this year. That's why stock gifts have really come to a halt.
Well, you also write about the ability to give to charities as alternative holiday presents. World Vision, for instance, the International Relief Organization, it's a Christian organization, has a holiday gift catalog. So how did they do?
It seems that that idea of giving gifts to charity in somebody's name is taking off. It's hard to tell yet how those results are going. They seem somewhat mixed. Some charities are doing well promoting that kind of a gift, and then others aren't. But anecdotally, we've heard a lot of people interested in that.
Well, and World Vision had a double-digit increase in contributions, but that was as of September 30th, the end of their fiscal year. So who knows, you know, if that continued through December. But Oxfam America hasn't had luck with its online holiday catalog.
In part, it's how groups promote these things and get the word out that they're available. And sometimes people just don't get the message. And in other cases, people who are very careful with their money may feel that they do need to give people more material goods right now because this may be their last chance to give that kind of a gift.
Well, what about the future? You know, what are charitable organizations doing? Because, you know, analysts tell us this is sort of the beginning of the impact of the financial downturn.
Next year is when they're really expecting both a serious increase in demand and stretched dollars. And nonprofits depend a lot on government money, not just on private donations. And certainly government doesn't have a lot of money available. It's going to be spending money on bailing
banks.
Out.
Yes,
yeah. And other causes. And so, you know, and state budgets have been hit very hard. That's really a double approach where the nonprofits get state money to fund their services, but also the states often turn to nonprofits to provide services, so they're going to be asked to do a lot more with a lot less.
Well, and corporate donations are obviously going to be down, and you write that some groups are making cuts anticipating that. Big Brothers and Big Sisters of Colorado cut its budget by 10%, even though it's going to get a 5% increase in contributions just because it anticipates that corporate donations are going to be down.
Right. As everybody looks at the year ahead, they can see the handwriting that it's going to be very tough.
And what about, you know, people who want to give? And again, you've got 3 days, you know, to reminding people if you want to still give this year. The Boston Globe reports today almost two-thirds of charitable donations collected by professional fundraisers here in Massachusetts last year went to the fundraising companies. Now, some of the charities are very small, and they say they need these pros to do the work for them. But, you know, of $285 million collected, only about $100 million went to the charities. What should the equation be, and how can givers be sure that their money is going to the charity and not to some, you know, phone calling service?
Donors have to be very careful to ask questions about where their money is going. And if you get a phone call from a solicitor, ask them right away how much of their donation is actually going to make it to the charity.
What's an acceptable equation?
certainly no more than 30% of overhead is appropriate. Some of those charities that are in that report, they probably hired these people not knowing that they were taking so much money. If you don't ask the question as a donor, then you won't know either, and you'll make a bad gift.
Stacy Palmer, editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Stacy, thanks so much for speaking with us. And again, how many days left to make a charitable donation in 2008?
3. Make them now.
Stacy, thanks.
Thank you.
You're listening to Here and Now. We've been reporting off and on the success of Massachusetts' landmark law requiring residents to have health insurance. One goal was to get more people to go to a primary care doctor instead of the ER for health care. And we've heard anecdotally that that is happening. But Here Now's Kurt Nickisch reports that emergency rooms are still seeing people who have chronic health problems that aren't being treated effectively by the system. He spent a Friday night following an emergency medicine resident at Mass General Hospital here in Boston.
It's 7 p.m., and Dr. Jennifer Millen is already 4 hours into her weekend shift. The 35-year-old is wearing scrubs, a black fleece, and tennis shoes. She's on her feet most of the time. Her blonde hair is pulled back. Right now, she's tending to a Haitian woman who's about 60 years old. The woman's legs are badly swollen. The family is bedside, translating the Haitian Creole.
She was having chest pain yesterday.
Millen's never seen this patient before. She probably never will again. But this is why she got into emergency medicine. Millen's being part of the nation's healthcare safety net, and she likes figuring things out. So she starts from scratch, jotting down the labels of the 5 bottles of meds the woman brought with her.
Did she miss any medications today?
No, she took them this morning.
She did? Can you just make sure? Can you ask? Yeah, you definitely took them this morning?
Yeah. Yes.
Millen is stumped. The patient's history is not adding up. That's typical here in the acute section of Mass General's ER, where the sickest patients come. On a Friday night, Millen sees many people who come in with serious chronic problems but couldn't reach their primary doctors on the weekend.
Some of the things we can't really do in the emergency room are manage long-term problems like high blood pressure or diabetes. That's a little frustrating sometimes.
Millen's job is not to heal patients, but to stabilize them and move them on for further care. It sounds simple, but sometimes this means figuring out tough cases with very little information. Her sickest patient tonight is an elderly man who's on a ventilator after a heart attack. The EMTs who responded had to give him drugs to be able to get a tube down his throat.
So he's paralyzed and sedated and completely non-responsive at this point. We're really not sure what happened.
By 9 p.m., Millen is handling at least a half dozen patients at the same time, and this is a relatively quiet weekend night. Patient load is supposed to be lighter under Massachusetts' universal health care law. The idea is that if people have insurance and therefore primary care, chronic health problems won't turn into emergencies as often. But so far, patient volume is as heavy as ever.
I usually, when I can, you never know when you're going to get a chance to eat.
Millen updates digital records at a computer while she snacks, and it's there that she gets the chest X-ray back from her Haitian patient.
I'm going to throw the ultrasound on. Oh, my gosh. That's huge.
For aspiration.
The X-ray shows a fuzzy area as big as a cantaloupe inside the woman's rib cage. It's her heart, the biggest heart Millen's ever seen. It's clear the woman has had high blood pressure for decades, but it still doesn't explain why she had to come into the ER now. Millen sends off for the woman's records from another Boston hospital, the last to treat her.
Sometimes there's just not enough information. I mean, we can't do everything in the emergency room. Even sometimes with all the testing in the world, you still can't figure out what it is. And that's when you really need someone to follow the patient and try different things and see what works and what doesn't.
The kind of things a primary care physician would do.
I think that's what we were looking for.
It took a couple of hours, thanks to federal confidentiality rules, but the other hospital has faxed over the records for the Haitian patient.
Oh, my gosh. She's, like, taking, like, 4 medications. She's supposed to be on 20.
That explains a lot. The records help Millen figure what to do. And by midnight, the woman's admitted to another part of the hospital where she'll get the right drugs to get her blood pressure and other conditions closer to normal. When Millen leaves around 1 in the morning, her job is over. Unless she follows up afterwards, she won't know how her patients turned out. It's up to the rest of the system now. Next time Jennifer Millen comes back to the ER, there will be new patients and new problems to figure out.
Here now is Kurt Nickisch at Mass General Hospital Emergency Room. Back with the Shack in 1 minute, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. What 2009 may bring is unclear, but one thing is pretty certain. The year will probably start with the paperback novel The Shack at the top of the New York Times paperback trade fiction list. It's been there for the past 31 weeks, most of that time at number one. The Shack poses the question, if there is a God, how can God let children be murdered? The protagonist at the heart of the book gets to ask that question of God, who, it turns out, is, at least on that day, an African-American woman. The Shack was originally written by a former office manager and hotel night clerk as a gift for his kids. It was published by two former pastors, spread by word of mouth, and was one of the biggest surprises of the publishing world this year. Reason enough for us to reprise our conversation with author William Paul Young, who, as we heard, had a lot in common with his protagonist, Mac.
When you write a story for your kids, a lot of your own life gets put in there because it's just for your kids. Nobody else is going to read this book anyway.
Well, we understand that's how it started. You wrote this for your 6 children, and there is a lot of your personal life, you know, reflected in it. Let's do that, shall we? Let's tell people, what are the connections between you and your protagonist, Mackenzie Allen Phillips?
A lot of it has to do with different kinds of pain that you grow up in. Mackenzie has a very difficult time with his own father, as do I. And we're still working on that.
You were the child of Canadian missionaries in New Guinea and suffered sexual abuse as a child.
I did, both inside the culture. I was 10 months old going in. I was the first white child ever into that world. The abuse that was part of that also extended into missionary boarding school and continued there.
Well, and your character, Mackenzie, has a daughter who is horrifically abducted and murdered.
I wanted to pick, and we've had the losses like that in our family in terms of death, not to that degree, but we had a 6-month period where my 18-year-old brother Stephen was killed, where my 5-year-old niece was killed the day after her 5th birthday, and my mother-in-law at age 59 died suddenly. So in choosing this particular scenario, for my children, I'm trying to choose something that will ask the best questions. And the best questions come out of the deepest losses.
Well, your protagonist, Mac, his daughter is taken to a shack and murdered. He goes back to the scene of that crime, and it's completely transformed. It is, in fact, sort of a Garden of Eden. And there he meets God, a jovial African-American woman, along with Jesus, who's Jewish, a Jewish carpenter, and the Spirit, who's an Asian sort of fairy, you know, of some sort. And he begins to have this weekend of, you know, asking them all these questions. What are some of the questions that you wanted to ask of God?
How does a good God and this world that is so often so destructive and people who make such destructive choices, how do those two things go together? Questions like, is the character of God certain? Or are we basically on our own? Also, there's this conflict between religion and relationship. I believe that God is all about relationship. That's why the Trinity makes so much sense to me. But religion is constantly positing a God that's angry at a distance, and now it's up to you through your behavior to try to find a way to that God. And everything I understand about Jesus is that God, in his affection, knows how lost we are and will find a way to us.
Let's just sprinkle in some of the answers that you come up with, or God comes up with, you know, in your character, in the book. First and foremost, how does God allow a child to be killed?
Part of it is because God has a tremendous respect for his creation. And that includes the ability of people to choose destructive things, that he's just not going to step in and make your choices for you as if you're now going to be some kind of a robotic character. But that in the midst of all of these myriads of human choices, some which are very destructive, there is a God who is at work constantly to redeem, to heal, to love, to forgive, and that affection is what draws us back into relationship.
And a God, as you envision her in this case. And by the way, the answer to that question, why is God in this particular visit that Mac has an African-American woman, she says, well, I try to be what you don't expect. So if you're expecting the white male, then I'm not going to go there.
And, you know, for my own children, I don't want them to be stuck inside of an image of God as a white Gandalf with an attitude. I want more of an understanding that God is spirit. He's not male or female. And the imagery that is even used in Scripture is not intended to define God as one or the other.
Well, one of the reasons that you couldn't find a publisher initially, and it was published by two former pastors, and you went into great economic, financial difficulty, is that Christian publishers thought it was, you know, heresy. Mainstream publishers thought it was too Christian. But going back to the heresy, you have Jesus saying when Mac asks that he doesn't believe that all roads lead to him. He says, no, I don't care if people convert. In essence, he's saying that Buddhists, Mormons, Baptists, Muslims, Democrats, Republicans, you know, I have a lot of followers and I'm not a Christian. That's a provocative line.
Well, it is only in the sense that we kind of put Jesus and Christianity now in the same box. You know, when somebody says, are you a Christian? My response is, well, please tell me what you think one is, and I'll tell you if I'm one of those. Because a lot of times I'm not. You know, I'm a Canadian, not a Republican. And I'm about the person and the beauty and the humility and the forgiveness and the love that exists in the person of Jesus. How can you attack that? And by the way, the publishers that rejected us didn't think it was heresy. They just thought it was too edgy. Heresy is a little strong. It's been used since then.
Well, but, yeah, I was going to say some conservative pastors, while other pastors are buying boxes of the books and, you know, handing it out to congregations, other conservative pastors have called it heresy.
And that's not a bad thing. You know, the idea that conversations would arise out of this story is so beautiful. And it's okay. People need to have a place where they can bring their stuff, even if it's theological or that's where they grew up or that's how they see God, or that needs to be part of a conversation. I don't say this is another book of the Bible. I don't say that this is a work of fiction. It's not 248 pages that I wrote for my kids.
But you're not a theologian either. And do you worry that people will assign to you some insight that, you know, maybe you don't have? I'm thinking of parents, and I'm wondering if you heard from parents whose children have been killed, you know, because you write, and I loved it when you wrote that Jesus says to you, oh, I was there with her. Oh, thanks.
See, and I believe that. And I get 50 to 200 emails a day. And these emails, some of them are the most wrenching stories that you can imagine. Mm-hmm. And people are finding in the words of this story the presence of God in a way that is meeting them in the midst of their great sadness. And I love that. And so I have not gotten any mail, zero, from people that are offended by what's being communicated in this story.
I guess I'm just saying, is that a burden to have, you know, parents of murdered children, you know, thinking maybe you have more insight into what happens, or, you know, is that a burden or is that a blessing that you're able to comfort them?
It's a huge blessing because I believe there is a God who does love us, who does pursue us, who does meet us in the midst especially of our pain and is there to comfort us. So it's not my gig. Mm-hmm. You know, at this point, I'm glad to be a roadie and thrilled to be a part of the process.
One last question. You mentioned you're a Canadian, although living in Oregon and writing beautifully, by the way, about the Oregon countryside.
Thank you.
But, okay, come on. What are the chances that when some human finally has interaction with God, God's favorite artist is going to be Bruce Coburn? you quote from a Bruce Coburn Canadian, of course, a singer-songwriter, who we love, too, but I was just surprised to find
out.
I
love Coburn. Let me tell you, he's my all-time favorite lyricist. When I wrote this story, my muse, if you will, was I want to write a story the way Bruce Coburn writes a song.
And we end with Bruce Coburn singing Lord of the Starfields, a song that's referenced in The Shack. We spoke to author William Paul Young earlier this year. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
You make my heart beat like a banner in the wind.